Hello and welcome to the Monster Legends Podcast. I'm your host, Tanner, and episode 2, we'll be talking about the monsters in Alaska. But first off, let's talk about little fun things about Alaska. If I can find it, add it up here. One second. One moment. Give me a minute. Cut this off of history.com. The largest state and area of the United States, Alaska was admitted to Union as the 49th state in 1959 and lies in the northwest of the North American continent. Acquired by the United States in 1867, the territory was dubbed Seward's Folly after U.S. Secretary of State William Seward, who arranged to purchase the land from Russia. Critics of the purchase believed that the land had nothing to offer. The discovery of gold in the 1890s created a stampede of prospectors and settlers. Alaska is bounded by the Beaufort Sea and the Arctic Ocean to the north, Canada's Yukon Territory and British Columbia Province to the east, the Gulf of Alaska and the Pacific Ocean to the south, the Bering Strait and the Bering Sea to the west, and the Chukchi Sea to the northwest. The capital is Juneau. It became a state on January 3rd, 1959. The population, of, according to the 2010 census, is 710,231. It is 664,988 square miles. Is it named the Last Frontier and Land of the Midnight Sun? The motto is North to the Future. The state tree is the Sitka Spruce. The state flower is the forget-me-not. The state bird is the willow ptarmigan, like ptarmigan. I'm not sure how you pronounce that. Some interesting facts. Russia controlled most of the area that is now Alaska from the late 1700s until 1867, when it was purchased by U.S. Secretary of State William Seward for $7.2 million, or about 2 cents an acre. Wow. During World War II, the Japanese occupied two Alaskan islands, Attu and Kiska, for 15 months. Alaska attained 17 of the 20 highest peaks in the United States. At 20,320 feet, Mount McKinley is the tallest mountain in North America. Alaska has roughly 5,000 earthquakes every year. Wow, that's crazy. In March of 1964, the strongest earthquake recorded in North America occurred in Prince William Sound with a magnitude of 9.2. Wow. The most powerful volcanic explosion of the 20th century occurred in 1912 when Rooftop volcano erupted, creating a valley of 10,000 smokes in Katami National Park. The temperatures dropped to a record negative 80 degrees Fahrenheit at Prospect Creek Camp in 1971. The state of Rhode Island could fit into Alaska more than 420 times. People have inhabited Alaska since 10,000 BCE, and the time a land bridge extended from Siberia to eastern Alaska, and migrants followed herds of animals across it. Of these migrant groups, the Atlantipans, Aleuts, Inuit, Yupik, Tinley, and Haida remain in Alaska. That's crazy. That's interesting. Alright, on to the monsters. The first monster is going to be Get my stuff up. The Tornit. Or the Alaskan Bushman. I got this off of mysteriousuniverse.org by this article by Mika Hanks, post June 10th, 2017. According to the 1901 edition of the Bulletin of the American Museum of Natural History, Volume 15, the Alaska Tornit are described as dustily. In early times, Tornit, a race of very large people, inhabited the country. They quarreled with the Eskimo because the latter intruded upon their land. This made the Tornit angry. He broke the ground with their lances and spears and split rocks into pieces. It is believed that Tornit and Lichquan, both races of giants, inhabit the interior. A legend about the Tornit was recounted in 1901 Bulletin, which told about how the giants would come to the house of the Eskimos while the men were off hunting and sometimes kill the women and children there. Another story tells of a pair of Tornit children, a boy and a girl, that were captured and assimilated alongside the Eskimo people. The boy became renowned for his ability to throw a spear, but permanently vanished into the forest after being made to demonstrate his skills by impaling an old dog in the village. The girl, it was said, eventually married one of the Eskimos in the village. According to the 1901 Bulletin, it said that in the Yulik country, the land still shows where how Tornit tore it up with their harpoon shafts when they were about to leave in fear of the Eskimo. Terry Toombs, a former Alaskan, now lives in Montana, wrote in 2012 about the legends of Tornits. Stories of the Alaska Bushmen, or Tornits, have been told since the first humans crossed the Bering Land Bridge. Toombs wrote, in the beginning, the story goes, the Inuit and the Tornits lived peacefully in villages near each other and shared common hunting grounds. The Inuit people often built and used caves for hunting, while the Tornits were unable to master the building of kayaks. They were very aware of the advantages of having and using one. One story goes that young Tornit brought a young Inuit's kayak without permission and damaged the bottom of it. Young Inuit became very angry and stabbed Tornit in the neck while he was sleeping, killing him. The rest of Tornits feared that they too would be killed by Inuit and fled the country, rarely to be seen again. Since that time, many stories have been come out about of the bush of hunters disappearing, later found dead, and mangled are never seen again. Apparently, hunters and Tornits never longer peacefully share common hunting grounds. Toombs told his own story about a fishing trip for salmon in the Jessica and Little Sutina rivers, where one cool and rainy spring they had been pulling in salmon when Toombs, his father, and his brother smelt an unusually skunky odor. Noticing that most of the other fishermen had left the area, Toombs' father released the holster on his .45, and the family quickly left the area. When asked why they were leaving, he told his sons, it had been a bear, although Toombs recalls seeing uprooted trees that had been thrust into the ground as they left the area. I learned many years later that there was that was a tall-tale sign of Bigfoot in territory, Toombs wrote. I guess I'll never know if it was a bear or a Bigfoot that placed us from fishing that evening, but I do know that that was the last time our family ever fished that river. It was also the first and only time the kids got to sleep, or at least tried to, in the camp trailer instead of the tents. As Toombs mentions, the modern folklore parallel to mysterious Tornit people, of course, is Bigfoot, the man-like beast alleged to exist in the remote parts of the Pacific Northwest. No conclusive proof for the existence of Bigfoot exists apart from first evidence in the form of footprint castings and the occasional films reporting to show the creature. However, it is interesting that so many American Indian legends contain parallels to the modern Bigfoot mythos in this way, constituting a small part of the broader wild man mythology gleaned from cultures worldwide. That's interesting. But same thing in this one. Okay. Okay. Here's a story about the tornado. It's by see the author is. Trying to find see the author is. It's on fairytales.com. In olden times, Inuit were not the only tribe living in the Eskimo country. Around Kerguelen Sound, there lived some very large, strong people called the Tornit. They were on good terms with the Inuit and shared the same hunting grounds, but lived in separate villages. They were much taller than the Inuit and had very long legs and arms, but their eyes were not as good. They were so strong that they could lift large boulders, which were far too heavy for the Inuit, though the latter were much stronger in those days than they are now. Some of the stones which they used to throw are lying about the country still, and the toughest of the men now living cannot lift them, much less swing and throw them. Some of their stone houses also remain. The Inuit lived in the houses all winter and did not cover them with snow to make them warmer. The principal part of their winter dress was a long, wadded coat of deerskins, reaching to the knees and trimmed with leather straps. They wore deer and seal, and when they were sailing in the winter, they fastened the lower edge of their coat to the snow by means of pegs. Under the coat, they carried a small lamp over which to melt snow when they were thirsty, over which to roast some of the seal meat. They sat around a hole in the ice and watched for their prey, and when a seal blew in the hole, they whispered, I shall stab it. Sometimes, in the eagerness, they forgot the lamp and upset it as they threw the harpoon and thus got burned. Their strength was so great they could hold a harpoon worse as easily as the Inuit could hold a seal. These weaker men did not like to play football with them, for they did not realize how rough they were and often hurt their playfellows severely. The playfellows tried to take in good part, and the two lived on friendly terms except for one thing. For some reason, the Tornis did not make kayaks for themselves, although they say how convenient they were for hunting when the ice broke up in the spring. Every little while, they would steal a boat from the Inuit, who did not dare fight for their property because the thieves were much stronger. This rankled in the hearts of the Inuit, and they would talk among themselves and threaten to take vengeance on the robbers. They debated what they should do, either to get rid of the Tornit or to make them cease their depredations. This state of affairs had gone on till the Inuit were at fever heat, when one day a young Tornit took the boat of a young Inuit without asking. In sailing with it, he ran into some blocks of floating ice, which dove in the bottom. The owner nursed his race into night, and when the thief was asleep, he slipped in the net, slipped into the tent, and thrust his knife into the Tornit's neck. The Tornit tribe had been aware of the growing dislike, and had when at last one of their Inuit took revenge, they feared that others might do the same in a similar secret fashion, so they decided to leave the country. In order to see if their neighbors, they cut off the trails of their long coats and tied their hair in bunches that stuck up behind to look like a strange people as they fled. Then they stole away, and the Inuit were so glad they were gone they made no effort to pursue them. Now, anything more? Anything else? Think I said for turn it. What's next? Number. Next up, we have the Thunderbird. This is from the Mysterious Universe again. Okay. Another creature in Alaskan folklore that may have ties to a real-life animal is a famous thunderbird. Although varieties of this gigantic mythical bird exist among several American Indian traditions, there is a prevalence of such legends in the cultures of Southeast Alaska and the Pacific Northwest. Stories tell of how the thunderbird was believed to hunt by hurling giant snakes down, known as Hateka, meaning lightning snake, at whales and other marine animals. On Friday, October 18, 2002, CNN reported on a most unusual development in southern Alaska. The reporter told of how a bird the size of a small airplane was recently said to be flying over southwest Alaska, puzzling scientists. Witnesses saw the bird say it was a small size of a small plane compared to something one would expect to see in popular Jurassic Park films. "He's huge. He's huge. He's really big," said John Booker, a local pilot that initially dismissed the reports until he and several others observed the birds themselves. "You don't want to have your children out." Some other things about. Came from. The same thing. This is from Mysterious Universe and Giant Birds. 2002, scores of Alaskans told the Anchorage Daily News they've seen gigantic birds overhead. Visitors from Chogiak and Monocotec in southwestern Alaska reported seeing the bird, which is much bigger than anything they have seen before. Moses Kupchak, 43, worked on his tractor when he saw the bird and couldn't believe it. "At first, I thought it was one of those old-time otter planes," he said. "Instead of continuing towards me, it banked to the left, and that's when I noticed it wasn't a plane." Pilot and owner of Bristol Bay Air Service, John Boker, were skeptical of the reports of giant birds until he saw one himself. While flying near Motoko, he looked out his window, and there was this big bird, he told Daily News. "He's really big. He's really, really big. You wouldn't have to want the children out, okay?" Raptor specialist Film Skiff said, "There's nothing the size of the bird alive anymore. I'm certainly not aware of anything with a 14-foot wingspan that's been alive for the last 100,000 years," he said, "that we know of." Okay. Any more? Me. About the da 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 da. Anyway, what's going on with you guys? You guys joined the Facebook group? Join my Twitter account? Listen to the last episode on Alabama. Alright, next one. Next monster. The Tizaric. Tizaric. Our teratomes, also known, there's a sea serpent of sorts, which is prevalent in Alaskan folklore. In mythology, the Teterek are large snake-like sea creatures that are believed to roam Alaska's waters. Tombs. They're described as having a head 7 feet long with a tail ending in a flipper, or a total of 12 to 15 feet long. Teterek were said to snatch people from docks and piers. In 2009, a surprising piece of footage taken by a fisherman off the Alaskan coast was appeared to show some large serpent-like creatures swimming in ocean waters. Paul LeBlond, the former head of the Department of Earth and Ocean Sciences at the University of British Columbia, was quoted by Discovery News saying, "I'm quite impressed with the video, although it was shot under rainy circumstances in a bouncy ship, it is very genuine." LeBlond is also co-author of the book Catboats Rosaurus, Survivor from the Deep, which makes the case for Caddy, name given to the sea serpent that casually is seen there in the region. Many have claimed to see Caddy over the years, and a number of carcasses have washed ashore which are believed to have belonged to a creature. Most of these, however, were identified later as the remains of known species like sharks and whales. "It must be a mammal, a reptile," LeBlanc said of the serpent-like creature in the Fisherman's 2009 film, since it oscillates up and down in a vertical plane which eliminates sideways oscillating fish. The description appears to be consistent with similar reports of the hump serpent-like creature seen along the Pacific coast for more than a century. It could be that all these creatures really aren't really legends, or... okay, yeah. Skyless, sorry, I got so many things. Different one. Three tomes. Shout out to Terry Tomes, by the way. My feet long, South Peak from water. There one. Okay. So, also, another source is Jason Offit, March 3rd, 2015, mysteriousuniverse.org. So there. The Yama Lake Monster. In a sparsely populated area of southwest Alaska, the number of residents in the entire region was 109 in 2010, lies the 1,012 square lake mile Yama Lake, home to Chinook salmon, lake trout, northern pike, and eelie, the Yama Lake Monster. The lake itself, 77 miles long, 22 miles wide, and 988 feet deep, is the largest lake in Alaska, capable of hunting the 30-foot-long square-headed beast. The monster, known as Konakadek by Native Tlingit Indians, was viewed as a god having the body of an orca, the head of a wolf, and was known to eat fishing boats. Early Russian explorers reportedly saw the creature at Yama Lake, and sightings have continued to this day. Modern reports come from explorers and biologists who have seen the 30-foot monster, sometimes described as a lemon-colored, other times as black with a white stripe. One report has an airplane snagging the beast with a tuna hook. The monster towed a plane around the lake before those aboard could release the cable. Experts have claimed the Yama Lake Monster is everything from a white sturgeon to a sleeper shark to a beluga whale, all she can reach to a length of about 20 feet and have access to the lake. But the locals know better. Yama Lake is home to a monster. I think I have something else on this. A story coming up. Lake Monster. From, what's this from? It's from the Alaska Cryptozoology Institute. Topblogspot.com. Okay. The Yama Lake Monster. The Yama Lake Monster is a large fish between 10 to 25 feet long. Skin is a dull lemon color. This creature looks very similar to a white sturgeon. Its behavior. The Yama Lake Monster spends most of its time submerged. When it is seen near the surface, it does not come up for air and moves its tail from side to side. This creature occasionally is out of the water and possibly collides with boats. Several scientists in the mid to late 1900s made up for the bulk of the evidence for this creature's existence, but native mythology also associates their monsters in Lake Yama. The story about the Konakadet, or the Yama Lake Monster. Next to Raven, the most popular subject for totem pole art was the Konakadet, known also today as Wazgo. This monster is generally depicted as an aquatic wolf with some aspects of the killer whale. One story about it relates that it had a head like a house, but whether this referred to its shape or to its size is no longer known. There are many Konakadet stories, but the most popular one concerns a high-born young man who was having mother-in-law trouble. Being the wife of a chief and used to having her own way, she seems to despise him because she could not dominate him as she would like it to, especially was she irked by his gambling. After each meal, she would order every bit of food put out of sight so that there would be nothing left when he came home. Then she would order the slaves to put out the fire so he would not cook anything for himself. When a gambler would come into the community house long after dark, the woman would remark sarcastically, My fine son-in-law has been cutting wood for me. A similar remark would be flung at him at every opportunity. Although the young man had a kind and loving wife, he found that he could not endure her mother's constant nagging forever. At some distance back of the village, there was a lake in which the monster Konakadet was reputed to dwell. Here, at the lakeside, he built himself a small cedar cabin where he lived alone. But he was not idle since it was his intention to try to trap the monster. First, he felled a tall cedar tree into the lake and carefully stripped it of its branches. Then, with fine hardened hardwood wedges and stone maul, he split the log nearly to the butt. Next, he inserted long cross pieces, which were spun the two halves wide apart and held them there at great tension. When summer came, the villagers left their fishing grounds. The young man went with them and caught many salmon. These he took to the cabin, and with them he baited his trap. By letting the bright red salmon down into water on the line, the Konakadet was finally lured into the space between the sprung tree halves, whereupon he knocked out the trigger, and the monster was trapped. For hours it thrashed about, at times dragging the tree completely underwater, but eventually gave up the struggle and died. Now the young man removed the Konakadet from the trap, skinned it, and carefully dried the skin. When it's cured, he got into the hide and went into the water. As he hoped, dressed in skin, he had all the powers of the Konakadet himself. He explored the lake bottom, finding there a beautiful house which had been the home of the Konakadet. The story of the good fortune he kept from everybody but his wife, and she was charged to reveal it to no one. The following spring found all the people's dried salmon used up, and the village was faced with the prospects of famine. Then the young man put on his Konakadet skin and swam in the sea every night. Only his wife knew his whereabouts, and to her only he revealed supernatural aspects of his gifts. "I will be back each morning for the raven calls," he said. "But if the raven calls before I return, do not look for me, for I shall be dead in this life." At night, he caught a salmon, and before the raven called he brought it to the village and laid it on the sand in front of his mother-in-law's house. Rising early next morning, this woman spied the salmon and concluded that it had drifted there with the tide. According to the custom, all the villages was invited to partake of it. The following night, the young man caught two salmon and left them in the same place. When the mother-in-law found these, she was overjoyed and wondered what it was that was bringing her this good fortune. It must be a spirit, she thought. The son-in-law now slept during the day, being tired from swimming in search of salmon all night. His mother-in-law would berate him suddenly, saying, "Imagine men sleeping all day when there is a famine. If it were not for me going around picking up dead fish, the whole village would starve." His wife, however, knew who was bringing the salmon. Next morning, the woman found a halibut for her door, testing her rhythm and the strange happenings, which the two halibut would be there on the morrow. The young man, hearing her predictions, fulfilled it by catching two halibut. Then she told her husband, the chief, to forbid anyone to go on the beach until she had gone first, given as her reason that she had a vision. Of course, she wished only to make sure that she should get full credit for everything that was found. Then she predicted that she would find a seal, and as she foretold, a seal was there in the morning. The hair was singled off, the skin scrubbed white, and the seal cooked whole for the benefit of the community. People now began to regard her as a great shaman, and she did everything in her power to encourage such belief. She ordered a claw headdress made such as shamans wear, and a rattle and an apron decorated with buffalo's beaks and a mask. She named food finding spirit. She continually talked about her spirits and sang songs about their powers. High caste people paid much attention to her and praised her spirits. Properly made her still more cruel to her son-in-law, and she now spoke of him derisively as the sleeping man. Okay. As time went on, she called successfully for two seals, one sea lion, two lions, one whale. Now she was selling food to the villagers, and had so much stored away in boxes that the people were awed by her great wealth. Each night, the task had been getting greater for the young man, and he had barely gotten in with the whale before the raven called. So to his wife, he cautioned, "Do not take any of that food unless she offers it." And then she added, "If I'm found dead in this skin, put me along with the skin in the first place where I used to hide it, and you will get help." Then the day came when a Swedo shaman called for two whales. The old man caught them, but to bring them in exceeded the strength even of the Kodai. All night long he struggled to get them ashore, but as he reached the beach, the raven fell and he fell dead instantly. How sad. The mother-in-law went out as usual and found the two whales with a strange monster lying dead between them. All the villagers came down to see it. It had claws like copper and a big head with long upright ears. Two great fans stood up on its back and it had a long curling tail. A simple villager sighed, it must be one of those shaman woman's spirits. Just then they heard someone crying, and upon looking in that direction, saw the chief's daughter approaching, whipping bitterly. "Why does the chief's daughter call that monster her husband?" they asked each other. When the girl reached the shore, she turned on her mother, angry, saying, "Where are your spirits now? You lied. You said you had spirits when you actually had none. This is why this happened to my husband." Everyone in the village was now crying about, "Mother, is this your food-finding spirit? Why did your spirit die? Real spirits never die. If this is your spirit, bring it to life again." Then the girl requested the help of someone who was spiritually clean, and they opened the monster's mouth, revealing the body of her husband. "He must have been killed by what that monster, said the villagers. Well, the woman and her helper went to deposit the body according to the dead man's instruction. They saw the trap and the tools he had made it with them. And then, for the first time, they knew the truth. All villagers went there to see for themselves and to pay their respects to the man who had saved them from starving. That is all but the mother-in-law, for her shame was more than she could bear, and she died in convulsions, bloody froth coming from her mouth. Every evening thereafter, the bereaved young lady went to a tree containing her husband's body and wept. But one evening, she perceived a ripple in the waters of the lake. Then she saw the Kodak rise. Speaking her husband's voice, it called to her. Then it said, "Get on my back and hold tight." She did so, and down beneath the waters it plunged. They still live there, beneath the surface, in a beautiful house, and numerous children are known as the Daughters of the Creek. They beside the head of every stream, and to see them or either other spirit parents Ursula for one, good luck. It's a very nice story.
We all know real life can suck sometimes, and your boss accidentally seeing you in your underpants on Zoom last week doesn't help any. That's why reluctantly codependent sisters, the Shira and Rishalia, keep you enthralled and in stitches every week with their podcast, Legendary Africa. Every Monday and Friday, we take you on a journey of mythical lands, magical objects, and monstrous creatures, both ancient and modern. Find Legendary Africa on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and wherever you feed your ears. And remember, stay safe, stay sexy, and stay legendary.
Here's some more credits in Alaska. Just quick from the Alaska cryptids, Bigfoot, Sasquatch, Kushtaka. Bigfoots are large ape-like human-like creatures. They usually stand between 7 and 10 feet tall. The body of a Bigfoot is heavily built, muscular, and covered in long, coarse hair, having brown or reddish brown in color. Behavior: Bigfoot spends most of his time in the forest and alongside the shoreline, where it observes running, walking, and even swimming in a frog-like manner. Evidence suggests that this creature is an omnivore. Bigfoot has been observed in areas where there are blueberries and has been seen chasing large game. These creatures are usually passive or curious about their stubborn report of terrifying aggressive behavior. There are even a few cases in which a Bigfoot allegedly killed or injured a human. Encounters with these creatures make up the bulk of this evidence. This instance, other evidence include nesting sites, deserted trees and vegetations, strange vocalizations, unidentified hair samples, and finds of strange humanoid skeletons. Stellar sea ape is an aquatic ape-like creature with unusual features. This creature's back is covered with grayish hair, its belly is reddish-white in color. The sea ape has many other unusual features, such as a long hog-like head, large eyes, and pointed ears. The animal has a shark-like tail, but no forefins or forefeet. Behavior: the creature has been only observed swimming in the waters of Aleutians using its shark-like tail. Explorer George Wilhelm Taylor describes a curious, playful, and intelligent creature when he saw this creature on an exhibition in Alaska. This creature was seen by George Wilhelm Taylor and Lucian Allens. A sailor also saw a similar creature in the Aleutians in the year 1969. People state these two sightings are only sorts of evidence for this creature's existence. Yeah. Kodiak dinosaur. The Kodiak dinosaur is a large plesiosaur-like aquatic animal, possibly a whale. Behavior is unknown. The fully functioning state of the art sonar of shrimp boat fishing off the coast of Kodiak detected a strange massive object in the water. The size of the state resembles a large dinosaur-like creature. It was detected about 330 feet below the surface and was about 200 feet in length. Wow. Okay, that's a good one. Were otters. The Kushtaka, or land otter people of southeastern Alaska, have terrorized the Tlingit peoples for centuries. Like the Kunukadak, was nothing enough to worry about. The Kushtak are a race of people who can shapeshift into otters, but not before ensnaring humans in a web of cuteness. Otters are adorable. And turning the humans into Kushtak themselves. Kushtaka often assume the form of a human loved one to ease deception. Once a human becomes a Kushidaga, his position in the afterlife is forfeit, a soul trapped upon earth. The Kushidaga are finicky folk, prone to the Kushida premonitions, 1 minute acts of kindness to the next, such as rescuing drowning sailors, or simply shredding a victim's flesh and spilling his entrails, you know, just because. The humans kept dogs to protect against Kushida. Not only could dogs identify Kushida because of their nature or the fact that Kushida may be carrying pot uncertain of the land, other people are afraid of dogs. They're also apparently afraid of copper, fire, and urine. Yeah, poor are afraid of urine. We stay up there and keep full of fire. Okay. I think there's a story. Cartoons. This is a story from Creepypasta about the Kushidaga. So, here goes. My name is Kevin Wilson. I thought it was right to write about what happened to me and my family. Before my incident, I was a very logical and skeptical man. I didn't believe in Bigfoot, werewolves, ghosts, or anything to that nature. They were just silly bedtime stories that my mother used to tell me. Nowadays, I'm not too sure what I believe. When I close my eyes, I can hear. I can see her, anyway. Before I get to the end of myself, I should probably start at the beginning, back before I met those things. My wife, Monica, and I lived in Reno, Nevada for basically our whole lives. When my wife got pregnant, I was happy. I was so happy. All my life, I had wanted to be a father and teach my children to grow up in the world. I can still remember the day that my son was born. He was small, fragile. And I was so happy that my dream finally was coming true. Of course, I was happy for Monica as well, giving birth to our beautiful child, Toby. A few years after Toby's birth, Monica and I started talking about moving. We wanted to get out of the city and desert and find a small, nice small community where we could raise our son. We searched for weeks, hundreds of cities in every state that didn't have the desert in it. Finally, after weeks of searching for the perfect city, Monica found the city of Juneau. It was the capital of Alaska, and yet only had about 3,000 people in it. We checked our budget and came to the conclusion that we would move to Juneau. When a plane landed in Juneau, it was raining. Not heavily raining, mind you. Just drizzling, more or less. We were told by some locals that it rains quite a bit in Juneau. We didn't mind it, though. We just wanted out of the big city's drifts and clutter. We had already made plans on renting a house and getting interviews for jobs before we moved up there. Just to be on the safe side, we took a cab and started our way to our house, which is in a part of Juneau they called Douglas. We had to cross a bridge to get to Douglas, which we learned from the cab driver was a large island next to mainland Juneau. He dropped us off in front of our house, and what a view we had of the water. We were on the beachfront in our own stretch of beach. We were going straight to the water. It was very beautiful, and we had thought that it made it the right choice for everyone. As we settled into our new house, I remember glancing outside and seeing an animal floating in the water, staring towards our house. I didn't know anything about animals, but I thought I should take a picture of it, just to realize that this was our good luck symbol. By the time I got in the camera and came back to the window, it was gone. I don't know it at the time, but the animal I was seeing was an otter. That night, I was woken up by strange noises coming from the beach. I got out of bed and looked out the window to see dark silhouettes running on all fours. I managed to grab my camera and snap a few photos of the things. I went back to bed. Next morning, I showed Monica and Toby the picture of the animals. They were amazed at the animals, and Monica thought they were, that whatever they were cute. I showed some of my coworkers the pictures, and one of them blurted out, "Oh, they would be sea otters playing in your property." I remember asking him if they were dangerous if played with only if for boats or unless it's Kushikataka. Everyone but me laughed, and what seemed to be a joke that went straight over my head. Don't make fun of them. A voice startled me, and I spun around to see who it was. A little man appeared to be an Alaskan native. The others sighed and went back to work, except me. I wanted to know what this Kushikataka was. Asked him why you shouldn't make fun of them, and he replied with a classic, "You're not around here, are you?" I shook my head, since there was no sense in lying. "Well," he replied, "Kushikataka is a Tlingit word meaning otter people. They are known for being strange and for killing humans." I went home that day thinking about how stupid that sounded. Shape-shifting human otters, what a joke that was. A few nights later, I was in the living room watching TV while Monica went to go drop Toby off at a friend's for a sleepover. I sat there, I heard a sort of scratching coming from the back door. I got to go look, and as I reached from the handle, I heard the sound of a baby crying on the other side. I froze as the sound made my hair stand up on end. The crying was coming just from outside the door when I just heard scratching noises. I wasn't skeptical, as I said before, but for a brief instant, every horror movie I ever watched came back to me. I shook the feeling off and opened the door. I looked down and stared at him with bright green eyes was an otter. That was very concerning for me, considering there were no babies there. I stared at it for a few seconds before I tried nudging it away with my shoe. As I touched it, it hissed at me and swiped at me, took a good chunk of my skin with it. I yelped in pain, and the otter scurried back to the water. I sat down, holding my wounds as it ripped blood onto the hardwood floor, and looked up to witness the otter standing on two legs and looked back at me. It gave me an early human-like grin, showing its sharp teeth and licking its claws. I don't know if my heart had ever beat that hard before, but I can say that honestly, I'd never been that scared for my life before. I quickly got up and slammed the back door shut and locked all the doors and windows. When Maka got home, I told her about what happened and showed her my wound. She took me to the hospital and she seriously tried to convince me that I was in shock and imagining the whole thing. I know what I saw though, and I don't know how to explain it to her without sounding crazy. After getting a series of rabies and tetanus shots, we went home. We walked in the front door. We could see that our house was thrashed, furniture torn up and scattered everywhere, dishes shattered, everything else in between. As Monica called 911, I noticed that the back door was wide open, had large claw marks running down it. When tourists arrived, they told us that they looked like a bear gotten in. I told them that I locked the back door and they were fine with, "Huh, that's strange behavior for a bear then." We cleaned up the mess with authorities, left, and went to bed. It took me a long time to sleep because with every creak of the house, I was reminded of the smile the otter gave me and left my blood from his claws. Weeks after all that happened, I was at the table eating breakfast with Monica. Toby then came downstairs from his eyes and looked at us. "I'll never forget the words he said next." He looked right at me and said, "The otter people told me last night they want to kill me." My heart sank at hearing those words, and every time I think about that day and what he said. Anyway, after he said that, Monica blamed me for filling his head with scary stories. She and I drove Toby to school and argued the rest of the way home about whose fault it was what Toby had said. That night, I couldn't sleep very well. I thought of what Toby said and Monica and I find I was a little on edge and restless, so I thought about I was sit go sit in the chair in the living room. I sat down to doze off, right as I heard a baby crying like before. I sat up confused and then became scared for Toby. I got up and ran to his room and checked on him. I opened the door to his room and froze in utter fear. Sitting over his bed was something ungodly hideous. It had the body of an otter, standing only about 5 feet tall. Its hands were like those of humans, but it had large, curved claws instead of fingernails. Its face was that of a half otter and a half man, with the same crooked smile that stared to my eyes with hypnotic eyes. I turned slowly towards it, and turned slowly towards me. I shook myself out of a trance, and looked at it to only feel its sharp claws enter my shoulder and its heavy body bouncing on me, knocked me to the ground. Without a piercing screech, I leapt off my body and ran to the door. I lay on the ground, holding my bleeding shoulders, as a loud chatter echoed through the house, followed by sound of Toby sobbing uncontrollably. I blacked out. I woke up in the hospital with a bandage around my arm and a few tubes sticking out of me. I looked around the room and saw Maka and Toby sitting next to me. Maka leaned down and kissed me softly, and Toby hugged me. I was so overjoyed to find out that they were safe. I actually cried. The doctor told me that my wounds were like I was attacked by a bear. I agreed, of course, because I know that I was not attacked by a bear. It was one of those Kushataka things. But as I tried to plead my case to them, they told me that I must have dreamed that is what it was. Okay. I couldn't believe that no one was listening to me while saying it. I know that would definitely sound like I imagined it, but it was still the truth. I stayed at the hospital for a few nights longer, recovered fully. My last night there, I had a very weird dream. I was under the water, swimming in the rain. I popped up above the surface of the water and staring at my house. I turned my head and glanced at what looked like four otters surrounding me. I nodded. They all then began to swim towards my house. I woke up in absolute panic and looked outside as rain pounded my window. I had to get out of here and go check up on my family immediately. I got dressed, and since I was on the first floor of the hospital, I jumped out the window. I ran as fast as I could, hoping that it was nothing more than a dream, and I would find them asleep in their beds. As I got to the front step of my house, I collapsed on the walking mat, gasping for air. I was soaked down to the bone, and my lungs felt like they were being crushed. As I regained my strength, I opened the front door slowly and was greeted with the darkness of my house. I tried the lights, but they did not turn on. I gulped and stepped inside further. Noticing the slight breeze coming through the window, I could see the back door was wide open and my heart beat faster and I walked towards my family's rooms. As I walked closer, my vision had trouble adjusting to pitch blackness that surrounded me. Suddenly, I stepped into something that squished under my weight and slipped out from under me. I landed on my back and immediately gasped as the air was knocked out of me. I lay there for a few seconds before I looked to see that what tripped me. Laying on the ground next to me was a body with entrails ripped out, limbs torn off, and face skinned. I stared in horror, for even though the person was virtually unrecognizable, I knew it was Monica. I turned away from it, not wanting to look at the abomination. Tears fell down my face and the valley slowly started sinking. After a few minutes, I heard a scream from outside. It was Toby. I got up quickly, shaking off the pain rushing down my back and heart. I sprinted out the back door from the back end to the beachhead. I stopped and I looked in the dreary eyes of a Kushataka, grinning quickly as I held Toby by his hair. Toby screamed and kicked, trying to get away from the thing's clutches. I cursed at it. Let my son go, you bastard, taking me instead. Kushataka smiled more, showing to his sharp teeth as he did. It acted like my pleas for mercy entertained it. It held Toby up further and put his hands under him, holding him like a child. It slowly started to pet his hair as it spoke in a crackled, dry voice. No matter what has or will happen in my life, I'll never forget the awful voice and what it said. It stared to my eyes and said, "No, I enjoy this too much." With those words, it pulled Toby's head back and sank his teeth into my son's neck. I screamed and watched in horror as it tore my son's neck out and then threw him at me. Toby landed on the ground with a thump, and I watched him die in front of me. Kushataka laughed and dove into the water, slipping into the black water. After cops cleaned up the mess and I was placed under re-question for murdering my family, I flew back to Reno so I could be away from the ocean. I will always remember everything that happened while we were up there, and I'll never forget those things that lurk in oceans, Because of the Kushka, I will never go anywhere near the ocean again. I cannot sleep in the dark anymore, and every time I hear a baby cry, I am reminded of those green eyes and that horrible smell. The thing that I'll remember most of all will be that voice and what it said to me. No, I enjoy this too much. Ooh, spooky, spooky story. What's that sound? Okay. Next up. Got these one. There's a So, a lot of people who are tall and ape-like, they are horribly ugly and covered in long coarse hair except where scabs and scars place it. Other people are also equipped with long claws. The other people are aggressive and deadly creatures. I would suggest they will chase and kill people and emit terrifying screams. Miner in the early 1900s had a terrifying encounter with these creatures at Thomas Bay. A trapper in Thomas Bay lost his dog, went out to look for it, and never returned. Okay. Okay, 3 minutes. What else got here? Have a good time. Make sure you subscribe, not subscribe, just listen to this on Spotify and podcast things. The Evil Inuit Mermaid, Qualipalik, from visitcryptoville.com. Here's a strange tale from the frozen north. Courtesy of the Inuit peoples. Qualipalik looks horrible, scares children, and waits patiently in the shadows of the kitchen. Kurtosali lovers will be reminded of other mermaid tales they've heard along these lines, but is this monster real? Inuit legends give us the tale of Qualipalik, who is described as a half human, half sea creature. Like other mermaids, she lives in the Arctic seas and is always searching for these faint children in Rome too close to the shoreline. They describe her as having long, wild hair, green skin, and fingernails so long they almost look like claws. She wears a garment called an amutik, which is worn by Inuit people to hold their babies on their backs, sort of like a backpack. That's how she carries away unsuspecting children. Inuit tell their children that if they are near the shore and hear the humming, the Qualipalik is near. She tries to entice them with the edges so she can grab them and take them away somewhere to hide. Some tales say that she eats the children, but most I read say she keeps them in a secret place to put them to sleep so they don't try to escape. These tales say she feeds off their energy to stay young, to keep her shiny green skin lovely and her wild hair lustrous. As the children age, Qualipalik grows younger. There is at least one tale where Bob's father, a skilled hunter, searched for his son ceaselessly. Qualipalik saw this and was afraid of being bound, so she let her son go. After that, the boy turned into a monster in the tribe and never disobeyed his parents or the elders again. Well. This makes a good story to keep the kids in line, especially when you're living in the vast wilderness with a treacherous season to pry. For me, I saw this creature taking child on its back into frozen waters instantly negates any possibility that the tale is real. The kids would die of hypothermia almost instantly. Unlike in other cultures, we have tales of the boogeyman, which lurks in the woods. Children are advised to stay close to families and do as they're told in order to keep safe. I guess it's a cautionary tale. Thank you for listening to this episode of Monster Legend Podcast. And to find more information about Monster Legend Podcast, go to monsterlegendpodcast.com or anchor.fm/monsterlegendpodcast. There you can find all episodes and platforms on which the podcast is on, which you can subscribe to. You also can email me with questions that will be answered on the show. Thank you.